We are the people of God, called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to that great day when the rule of God will fill the earth. It is good to be together as His people. A few weeks ago, we began what is a kind of an extended series in the first part of 2020 to explore several key passages from the prophets. And if you've been with us at all, you begin to recognize, well, that's not kind of normal stuff. We're turning to passages where you might say, I don't read this very often. And some of it's kind of confusing. And who are these old guys that are talking? And not me, the prophets. How do you make sense of this? Well, that's a normal reaction. That's okay. That's one of the reasons we're spending some time in it, because it's still extremely valuable. If you'd like a little more help with that, I want you to know that there's actually at 9:30 every Sunday morning, an adult Bible fellowship group that meets, and in that group, the previous week's sermon text is the object of discussion. So if you'd like to kind of grapple with these texts a little more deeply and think about, man, how do they really apply? How's this clicking with me in my life? How is our faith growing because of these texts? And I encourage you to join Faith for Life. If you're not committed to another part of our church function at 9:30 in the morning on Sundays, please come join us, join the discussion, and you'll find the fellowship rich and the stimulation of your faith, I think, to be quite helpful. I can still picture it. That day when I stood at the altar in a little Baptist church in Michigan, and I cast my eye down the aisle, and here came my bride, dressed all in white, and the organ was playing, and the congregation was standing, and my heart was beating so loudly I thought maybe the people would tell me to quiet down. It was as if time stood still. I knew this would be one of the greatest days of my life. And as I stood there, I'm sure that I was convinced that this reality was going to take place in our lives, that I was going to be totally devoted to this girl, and this girl was going to be totally devoted to me, and this was going to be a wonderful future together. Kind of funny, actually, because there's so much I didn't know on that day. I didn't know where we'd live. I didn't know how we would live. I didn't know if we'd have kids or what kind of kids. I really didn't know what was going to happen with my education. But I knew this. I was going to be devoted to her, and she was going to be devoted to me 100% for certain all the time. How naive. Because it's just not quite that easy. Little did I know that my desire to be completely devoted would be very much tested in the days ahead. The premarital counseling was really quite good, and the conversations were helpful, and the wedding vows were sincere, and the wedding rings would stimulate our commitment to one another. And yet, I learned in the following years how very difficult it is to be 100% committed to one person all the time. If you're married, you know what that's like. For you see, it wasn't long after that wedding day that the realities of poverty began to pull at us and pulled us apart a bit. And then it was infertility that brought doubts that we should really be together. And then demands of my own graduate education began to pull us apart. 12 years of graduate education. And being 100% devoted only to my wife, that was hard. And then I found that employers wanted my full devotion. And I wanted to give my heart to some sports and some hobbies along the way, and that pulled me away from my wife. And sometimes my wife, rightfully so, would just express some disappointment that she wasn't getting the attention she so rightfully deserved. And then, of course, I was around other professional, beautiful women who somehow had a magical attraction for my heart. And staying devoted only to my wife? Wow. Extremely difficult. Something I never saw on that wedding day at the altar. If that kind of exclusive devotion to an individual is hard in marriage, how much more difficult and challenging when we're talking about our devotion to one God? For you see, staying devoted exclusively to God is hard. When we meet the Lord Jesus at the first time, perhaps, we start with such good intentions. I mean, we know we're going to be the kind of people who, well, we regularly read our Bibles and pray, and we walk with the Lord, and we have His Spirit, and we know that days are going to be sweet, and God's going to bless us, and it's just going to be a wonderful life, just you and Jesus, and me and Jesus, and God's people, and we know we won't have any trouble staying devoted to Him until life hits. And the pressures come, and our allegiance gets tested and strained. Your work, my work, actually can pull us away from the Lord, and He doesn't get much time and attention. And the life that we expected, perhaps, with job and house and car and family, well, it doesn't materialize exactly like we want, so we start seeking prosperity, not from His hand, but through our effort. And the desire for more time to ourselves, to slip away and get out of town, it means that we spend less time with God's people and less time, perhaps, with God Himself. And perhaps after years of kind of going through life, the relationship with our God just kind of stagnates. It grows a little cold, and the temptation is not to be all in 100% exclusively devoted to Him like we thought we would. Staying devoted only to God, it's hard. It's challenging. What will God do to win our exclusive devotion? What does God do to gain over our absolute allegiance? Because if I know what He's doing in this relationship, well, perhaps it will encourage me and it will stimulate us to maintain that allegiance as well. What does God do? The short answer is this: He takes extreme measures to gain our allegiance, to gain our exclusive devotion. Our God takes extreme measures. This morning we want to explore those measures. We'll actually look at two measures, two actions that God does, and they're actually amazing what God does to keep His people close to Him alone. And then after seeing what God does, we'll spend a few minutes looking at how He expects us to respond in the midst of this day. We're going to look at a time in the life of Israel when they had certainly lost their 100% devotion to God. They started out good, but after the centuries had gone by, they found themselves no longer devoted exclusively to Yahweh, their God. And God was calling them back. And God was telling them, I want your devotion completely. And here's what I'm going to do to get it. So God gives to Israel the extreme measures that He would take to wrestle their devotion away from false gods. and what he tells Israel is good for us as well. So the first action of God, it's this. God cuts off blessing to cut off his people from false gods. God cuts off blessing. He stops it. He removes it sometimes in order to cut off his people from following after false gods. We see it in Hosea chapter 2. So if you have your Bibles, let me invite you to turn to Hosea. That's that skinny little prophet in there after Ezekiel, fat prophet, Daniel, fat prophet, Hosea, skinny prophet, and then Joel and Amos. So if you don't have a search function in your paper Bible, that's where you'll find it. Now, this all sounds pretty simple, that God is going to cut off blessing, to cut his people off from false gods. But don't be deceived. God is going to appear to be like a surgeon with a very sharp scalpel. And he is radical in what he removes. This isn't just a tonsillectomy or an appendectomy or a tracheotomy. This is going to be a removal of Israel's blessing, and it is extreme. It is an extreme form of discipline so that God can say, I want your 100% devotion to me. We see it, first of all, kind of overviewed in Hosea chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, where God says he wants their exclusive devotion, and because if it doesn't show up, he's going to embarrass Israel with the removal of her blessing, embarrass her publicly. Chapter 2. Verse 2, rebuke your mother. Huh? I thought you said this about Israel. Sounds more like a woman. Well, actually, the language here is Hosea's children talking, being told to talk to their mother. So Hosea is saying to his children, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, plead with her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. I'll make her like a desert, turn her into parched land, and slay her with thirst. We'll stop there for just a second to make sure we understand what's going on, because this is a little bit confusing, right? It sounds like he's talking about Hosea and Gomer, you remember that story that unfolded, but he's really talking about Israel. So let's see if we can get our arms around this. He is, in fact, using language that would be true of Hosea speaking to his children and saying to his children, I'm so fed up with your mom. I want you to talk to her. I want you to rebuke her. I want you to plead with her earnestly. I want you to do all you can to tell her to stop this adulterous lifestyle that she's been living. It's as if I'm not even her husband. And she's not really even my wife. Now, they were married. You'll recall back in chapter 1 that God had indeed instructed Hosea somehow to marry this adulterous woman, this prostitute, who was giving herself to other men, and he did so as a picture of the relationship between Israel and God. And so it's very evident in verse 2 that what God is doing here is he's calling out and he's saying, look, I want to have a relationship with you, but here's the terms. It has to be a 100% exclusive devotion from you to me. And he puts it in terms of as of a wife who'd been a prostitute, who is a prostitute, to her husband, but the message is really for Israel, that God's people will sense this call. Now, Hosea is being called to this exclusive devotion. You can almost hear her children, right? Mom, won't you stop this and just be devoted to Dad? Mom, could you cut out this lifestyle? It's really hurting us. Please, just give all of your allegiance to Dad. That's the tone in this first verse here, chapter 2 and verse 2. That she is supposed, their children are exhorting her to to clean up her face, meaning probably take off your makeup that would you be using to woo other men to yourself, to get rid of the ring that's likely in her nose and the perfume that's between her breasts that would always be so enticing to other men. Get rid of all that stuff, Mom. You can't live that lifestyle. You can't attract others. Why? Because if you don't, Dad's going to do something really extreme. Notice what he says. Dad is going to embarrass you publicly. Otherwise, verse 3, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. What? Sounds like cruel. No, no, no. In the ancient Near East, we actually have records that because essentially, adultery or prostitution was an act whereby a woman would reveal her nakedness to her lover. The punishment would be that her nakedness would be revealed in the public square. That the punishment fits the crime. You want to be naked? Fine. And the public embarrassment would be overwhelming, extreme. In fact, the text says she's going to be like a desert and a parched land. You see it there in verse 3. In other words, I'm going to remove the food from her. I'll remove water from her. She'll be impoverished. She'll have no ability to do anything except thirst, and that thirst might just well kill her. Wow. Again, while the language is speaking in terms of Hosea and Gomer, the message is for God's people. Israel. And so the prophet is saying to these people, look, God is calling you, Israel, to an exclusive allegiance to him, to you, to him, and he is saying that you need to see what I will do to make this happen. I will take extreme steps. I'll even cut off the blessings that you have enjoyed to cut you off from your false gods. Well, this is kind of the introductory verse. And it's interesting because I suspect if Israel hears this message, they're going to be shocked. Think of it. Prostitution is probably often viewed as kind of a secret sin. It's done in darkness. It's one of those things that you could do and hide from a lot of people. And therefore, the public exposure was going to be a particularly extreme measure of action by God. For Israel to think, I can get away with a little time with the false gods. It's okay if I pray to Baal. It's okay if I engage in these other worship ceremonies. It's okay if I give a little allegiance to other gods just to cover my bases. I can still worship at the tabernacle. I can still thank Yahweh. I can still do all the things that I would normally do, and no one would even know. And God says, no. This will be a public exposure of your adultery. And the coming verses show how extreme is this action by God. He's going to prove over and over that when his people pursue false gods, God will cut off the blessing in order to cut them off from their false gods. Now, we're going to take a minute and read all of verses 4 through 13 because probably we aren't very familiar with it. It's a powerful text. You're welcome to read along and follow along as I read. Pay attention especially to all the times that God says, I will, I will, I will, and you'll get the flavor, even if not everything is clear, you'll get the flavor of God saying, I'm taking action because I want your devotion completely. Hosea chapter 2, verses 4 through 13. I will not show my love to her children. And now I think he's talking about Israel, because they are the children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and conceived them in disgrace. She said, I'll go after my lovers who give me my food and my water and my wool, my linen, my olive oil, and my drink. Therefore, God says, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. Oh, she'll chase down after her lovers, but not catch them. She'll look for them, but not find them. And then she'll say, I'll go back to my husband as at first, and that was better off than I am now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain and the new wine and the oil. I was the one who lavished on her the silver and gold and which they used for the worship of Baal. Verse 9, therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens and my new wine when it's ready, and I'll take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her naked body. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals and her new moon and her Sabbath days, all the appointed festivals. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I'll make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after her lovers. But me, she forgot, declares the Lord. All of these verses can be wrapped up with a concept that God is saying to Israel, I want your exclusive devotion to me, and I will do this to make it happen. I will cut off your blessings to cut you off from your false gods. Let's just take a few of them here, and we'll kind of look at some of the details. Of course, Israel's error is that they pursued these false gods. I don't think this was a decision where Israel said, oh, wow, let's just abandon our relationship with Yahweh. I know he got us out of Egypt and got us into the promised land, but now we'll just forget him. No, that's not the way it worked. It was probably more cultural pressure. You know, there were Canaanite worshipers in the land and other nations within the land that Israel failed to remove, and they all had their gods. And there was a day that, you know, the rain didn't come, and so they said, hey, who do you pray to? Would you pray for us? And then there was a day that a baby was born and died, and the community would have been in a terrible uproar. And so they said, oh, your God is a fertility God. Maybe we should pray to Baal and that life would be preserved. And it probably just started as a little thing. And then it got worse and worse and worse until eventually God, Yahweh of heaven, looks down, he sees his people, and he says, no, you're not devoted to me. You've been chasing after these distracting other gods. And so he says, here's what I'm going to do. A little bit more about what they have done. They have been seeking life, food, water, olive oil for burning lamps, drink for joy from Baal. Did you see it there in verse 5? Back in the text at chapter 2 and verse 5. Look what they did. It says, I will go after my lovers who gave me my food and my water and my wool and my linen, my olive oil and my drink. Wait, where did you get those things? Israel's saying, oh, well, we got them from Baal. And the Lord is looking from heaven saying, what? On top of that, they didn't see Yahweh as the provider of life and prosperity. They didn't acknowledge him. They didn't look back at the end of their day and say, wow, we have food and life and clothes and prosperity from the hand of our God. In fact, they used the things from God to help them in their worship of the idols. The blessings that came from God, they used to worship false gods. And the conclusion was they forgot Yahweh. You saw it, verse 13. Me, they forgot. So God says, here's what I will do. I'm going to remove the blessings of life and prosperity in verse 9. I'm going to bring public embarrassment in verse 10. But God's purpose is not just to punish Israel. Did you catch it? It's not just so that Israel gets a spanking and feels bad. This is not a matter of God winding up his fist in order to knock out his people. He's taking this action because this will be necessary to cut them off from the false gods they follow. Because you see, what does he say in verses 6 and 7? He's going to block their path to idol worship. Verse 6, therefore I'll block her path with thorn bushes. I'll wall her in so she cannot find her way. You get this picture of Israel as this people looking for their worship with their false gods. But God says, no, I'm not even going to let that happen. I'm going to wall them in. And in fact, you want to use the grain that I gave you for worship of Baal? I'll take the grain away. You want to use the gold and silver that I gave you in order to make idols? Well, I'll take the gold and silver away. You want to attribute your clothing and your warmth to Baal? I'll just take it away. And now you have nothing with which to worship a false god. You see, there's a purpose in God cutting off the blessings, and the purpose is not just to make Israel feel bad. It's to literally make it so they can't pursue the idols, false gods. In fact, no more festivals. Even though the festivals were part of the Israelite worship service, they'd become so corrupted with Baal worship, false god worship, that God says, I'll just cut them off. You won't even be able to do that. Of course, he's going to take them out of the land. So Israel was wooed by Yahweh to give him exclusive devotion, and to encourage us, he said, I'm going to cut off your blessing to cut you off from false gods. Makes you glad you weren't in Israel, right? Could God work like this today? We're not Israel. We don't live under the same Mosaic covenant. Yet God still passionately and intensely desires our exclusive devotion to him alone. Even Jesus will pick up on this when he says, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. There is one God established from the beginning, and one way to approach that God. And even Christianity has been rooted in the reality that there is an exclusive allegiance required to our one God through his one Son. But we sure can slip away from our allegiance to God, can't we? Like Israel, we fail sometimes to see that all of life really has come from his hand. You know, life comes from doctors and medicines. Our security comes from our alarm systems and our insurance. Our joy comes from our entertainment processes and programs. Our prosperity, well, that comes because of our education, our effort. And we become self-reliant instead of God-reliant. And God calls this spiritual adultery. I expect that God will be so patient as he was with Israel. And then he comes to the point where he says, I am going to expose your adultery. Could it be that sometimes we lose jobs, we get sick, and houses get destroyed, and cars get wrecked, and jobs get lost? And while these are not always a direct result of God's response to a spiritual adultery, so I'm saying that very clearly, sometimes God could take such extreme measures just to call us out and embarrass us so that with those things gone, we can no longer ignore him. And we're forced to say, I can only depend on you, because I can't make my life go forward. I can no longer make my life flourish. My friends, I really believe that when we need a boost of our allegiance to God, this is the kind of action that God may choose to take. He may cut off our blessings to cut us off from chasing false gods. I said to you that what God does is extreme, right? Well, the first measure is this cutting off of blessings to cut us off from God. There's a second action of God that's also quite extreme, and it's kind of like just the opposite. To win our allegiance, God promises a perfect love relationship and extreme blessing in the future. To win our allegiance, to gain our 100% devotion, to keep us really coming after Him, God says, look, in the future, we'll have a perfect relationship. And it's going to be a future filled with blessing of my goodness. That's the whole point that God says to Israel in the last part of this chapter. So we'll read again as we look at how God is going to say, watch what I'm going to do in the future. And just like the first time we listened for, I will, I will, I will, and they were all pretty extreme measures of God to take action against Israel, now we're going to see God say, I will, I will, I will, and all the news is good news of what God is going to make happen. We're in Hosea chapter 2, verse 14. The most surprising verse, maybe in the Old Testament. I mean, this is looking really bad, and then God says, therefore, verse 14, I'm going to allure her. I'm going to draw Israel in. I'm going to pull her to myself. I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she'll respond as in the days of her youth, as in the days she came up out of Egypt. We'll explain this in a second. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You'll no longer call me my master. I'll remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day, I'll make a covenant for them, a covenant with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice and love and compassion. I'll betroth you in faithfulness, and you will know Yahweh. You will experience Him in a way you never have before. In that day, verse 21, I will respond, declares the Lord. I'll respond to the skies, and they'll respond to the earth, and the earth will respond to the grain, and the new wine, and the olive oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called, not my loved. I will say to those called, not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. The extreme measure of God here to win the allegiance, the 100% fully devoted, exclusive devotion of His people, the action of God is to promise extreme blessing and a perfect relationship with Him in the future. God promised extreme blessing. Look at some of the examples. Verses 14 and 15. He's giving Israel an Exodus-like experience, a re-redemption. Did you see how He says it? I'm going to allure Israel, and I'll lead her into the wilderness. Now, you might look at that and go, wilderness? What kind of blessing is that? No. The wilderness is a lot better place than Egypt. And what God is saying through His prophets, look, remember how back centuries ago I took you out of Egypt and you got into the wilderness? Remember what that was like? You were so excited because you went from a really, really bad situation of trouble to a position of hope. You knew that you had no future in Egypt, but I've pulled you out, put you in the wilderness on your way to the land where the kingdom would flourish and good things were ahead. You went from despair to hope. That's what God is saying. And you're going to sing, Israel, now, just like you did in that day. I'm in the process of redoing your redemption. God promised extreme blessings from the heavens and the ground, from the heavens to the ground and all the animals of Israel's life to bring security and prosperity in the land. We won't reread the verses. Verses 18 through 23, it's a great picture here because he says, look, I'm going to make a covenant with anything that would tend to destroy your blessings. So, you have problem with birds and beasts and creatures on the ground? No problem. I'm going to make a covenant with them so that they can't destroy any of your stuff. War? No, I'm taking care of all the swords and the things that would deal with warfare. That can't happen. In fact, he says, I'm going to be so responsive that when the seeds essentially from the ground, which are planted, cry out through through the wine and the grain, the grapes and the grain, and that cries out through the dirt, and that cries out into the heavens, I'm going to answer, and I'll cause response so that your life flourishes. He gives picture after picture in this chapter of how indeed God is going to bring extreme blessing for his people, and it's wonderful. But perhaps the best part is the perfect relationship with him. Verses 16 and 17 begin to unpack this idea of how Israel is going to have a heartfelt devotion exclusively for Yahweh. Verse 16, we need to pay our attention here to this element. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You'll no longer call me my master. Now, this is a fascinating little text because the word for master is also the word Baal. And that's actually still true in other Semitic languages today. In Ethiopia, when I go there, it's not unusual for me to introduce my spouse as, or especially for Cindy, to introduce me as Baalebe, the supervisor of the house, the master of the house. That's what that means. And in Israel, they could call their spouse or husband a Baal. But it usually kind of emphasized position and authority and, you know, contractual obligation. He's my Baal. And God says, that word is going to be so despicable to you that you're going to call me my husband. A term of affection and endearment. You won't even want to utter that word. Baal. It'll be stricken from your vocabulary. Such a thing of your past. Why? Because the relationship with the Lord is perfect. God promised a perfect relationship with him. You come to this great climax in verse 23, and he says, look, those who are not my people, I'm going to call them my people. And then did you see the last line? They will say, my God. Our translators are kind because they put in for us the full sentence, you are my God. It's actually simply, my God. Not in disbelief, but in awe and in wonder. He has called us his people, and he alone will be our God. God says, I will do what it takes to get your exclusive devotion. I will promise you future blessing that is so extreme. I will promise you a perfect relationship. Like Israel, we have much to look forward to. One day our hearts will be perfectly tuned to his. One day my longing will only be for him. One day I will never look at a false affection. I'll never be drawn with distracted attention from God. One day my relationship with him, your relationship with him, will be absolutely perfect. How do you respond to that? If God will take such extreme measures to cut off blessings so that his people are cut off from false gods, if he'll make such an extreme measure of promising this incredible future of blessing and perfect relationship, how do we respond today? Well, there's actually a hint of that in this text as well. The statement is this: love God alone as we anticipate our future perfect relationship with him. Love God alone, exclusively, 100% devoted as we anticipate that future relationship with him. Chapter 3 kind of illustrates this with Homer and with I knew I'd say that at some point, Gomer and Hosea. And he says to her, we won't take time to read all the verses, but just notice verse 3. When Hosea goes back and loves his wife, chapter 3, verse 3, he then says, I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I'll behave the same way toward you. Hosea says to Gomer, look, a time's coming when things are going to be better. But for right now, you just stay committed to me. No more chasing after false gods. No more quick prayers to cover your bases. No more going to the fertility cults to make sure that you get what you want. You give your allegiance to me, and one day, the blessings will come. And then he turns to Israel, and he makes this statement in verse 5. Chapter 3, verse 5. Afterward, the Israelites will return. That's from exile. They'll seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days. God is saying to Israel and to us, for now, love me fully. Be 100% devoted to me as you anticipate future blessings and a perfect relationship. I don't know what was going to pull at you this week, but I know we live in a world where there are all kinds of things to pull us away from devotion to God. Oh, my friends, let's heed this wonderful word from Hosea. Not to be distracted, not to be pulled away, not to allow our affections to be captured by anything other than our God as we anticipate the future. I will tell you that by God's grace and something very special, I think that if I can make it to June, we will celebrate, my wife and I, 40 years of marriage. That makes me feel old. But how did that happen? I will tell you that one of the ways that it happened, one of the significant factors in it happening, is because I have a wife who takes extreme measures to keep me devoted. She works hard to make sure that she and I know that my allegiance is to her. How much more so our God, who takes extreme measures to keep us close to him. And so, our Father, we want so much to have this kind of devotion to you. And I pray for my brothers and sisters and for myself that you'll impress upon us how deeply you desire to have our devotion, and how extremely you will act to gain our devotion. Encourage us, I pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen.